It is Your Money. I'm Susie Jones. So happy to have you with us on this chilly morning in Minnesota. Once again, we welcome to the program Bruce Helmer, the founder of Wealth Enhancement and financial advisor. Bruce, good morning. How are you?
Hello, Susie Jones. I'm actually well. I trust you are well, my friend.
Yes, we are dealing with the freezing cold in Minnesota and a lot of tumultuous activity, but we carry on.
Yeah, we are kind of the epicenter again, unfortunately, of a lot of unrest in the country. And we'll probably even talk a little bit about that today because, Susie, what we're talking about today, and Peg is taking a day off, but we're very, very fortunate to have in her place Doug Huber. Doug is a Deputy Chief Investment Officer at Wealth Enhancement. He's been in the industry over 15 years, the last five with Wealth Enhancement, and is frequent listeners to the show know, every so often we like to do a show where we talk a little bit about where markets have been, what we just saw, what we expected, what we didn't expect, and what we anticipate going forward. But, of course, we always have the caveat that nobody ever knows what the markets will do in the short term, but we'll tell you what we think might happen based on the best evidence that we have now. And political unrest and turmoil and those things can feed into market performance. So we'll probably actually talk a little bit about that today as well. Doug, if you're there, thank you for being with us. I appreciate your time. Good morning.
Yeah. Morning. Great to be with you, Bruce. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Doug, maybe before we dive into some specific information about markets and what they've done and what we think they're going to do and what is influencing them, I don't think Peg and I talk as often as we should about you and your team. Can you give listeners some insight into your team, how big it is, what are the logistics, how does it work? You're the folks that manage portfolios on behalf of our clients. Talk a little bit about the logistics and the process and the team, and give listeners some insights, kind of how the sausage is made.
Yeah, absolutely. So myself and my team are really responsible for driving the investment process and the portfolios that are managed by Wealth Enhancement Advisory Services. And so that's leading kind of three functional areas. If you were to think about it, we have a team that's devoted solely to the sourcing, the due diligence, and the monitoring of kind of any external managers. So think, you know, all the asset managers out there, the Fidelities, the Vanguards, you know, the list goes on. But anybody where we're turning over kind of the discretion to manage a piece of the portfolio. So that could be with ETFs or mutual funds or other vehicles. So we have a team dedicated to just making sure we go out and source the best partners we think are available to put into our portfolios. We also have two other teams that manage portfolios internally. So we have an internal equity team that runs four different strategies for our clients inside of Wealth Enhancement. And we also have an internal fixed income team that runs six different internal fixed income SMAs. And those are really there as options and complements to everything we do with our outside partners. And so we lead those functional areas. And then really the team's whole goal is to really monitor the investment landscape, all major asset classes, alternative asset classes. And at the end of the day, we're really here to ensure that our advisors have these really competitive solutions that we think are the highest quality investment choices available to our advisors and clients.
Doug, a couple of things that I tell clients, and maybe you can comment on this. I always tell clients that our goal at Wealth Enhancement, contrary to maybe your personal goal if you're a do-it-yourselfer, or maybe even if you've worked with another financial firm in the past, our goal is not to get the highest possible return. Our goal is to look at each individual situation, determine their goals and objectives, like things like when do you want to retire, how much income do you want at retirement, do you want to leave a legacy to loved ones, do you want to be charitable, all those things. We find out what makes a person tick, what's important to them, what their core values are, then their goals and objectives, and we try to determine what's a return on investment that we need to get to achieve those goals, and then let's get that return with the least amount of risk possible. Would you say that's consistent with how you run the portfolios internally in the investment management team?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it is not our job on the investment team to determine a particular client's risk approach, you know, to force them into anything that is not suitable for what they're trying to achieve. And so you're absolutely right. Really, that discussion begins with the advisors and the clients themselves to determine kind of what is the goals they're trying to achieve. And then, you know, loosely, what are the kind of goalposts that we're trying to stay within to build out that portfolio. And so it's really that plan-led investing. That's really where we come into the picture, where the advisors engage with our investment teams, say, okay, you know, here's what we're trying to do. Here's the risk parameters. How help us build the appropriate allocations and portfolios for this particular situation? So it is not a one-size-fits-all. We know that every client is different, not only in terms of their absolute wealth, but what they're trying to do with it. And so we want to make sure that we can offer that customization, that really that white glove approach, to make sure that our advisors and clients are getting the right thing for the right situation.
That's great. And the other thing I always tell them, you know, is that we literally these portfolios that you and your team manage, we're very proactive. We're very attentive. You and your team literally are looking at these portfolios every day that the market is open. And sometimes I think people express skepticism about that we can watch it that closely and watch it every day. But my point being, that attentiveness probably over time has a very high degree of likelihood of enhancing returns, but maybe even more importantly to clients, probably reduces risk. Can you talk at all about the logistics and what your teams look at on a daily basis?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that actually goes to a second point I'd love to tie into it. You know, you're spot on, right? We are keenly aware of what's going on both in the macroeconomic arena. So we're paying attention to all of those big data points like the labor markets, inflation, you know, all the things that kind of are the higher level drivers of what's going on in the economy. And then we also pay very close attention to, I think now it's teetering on almost 100 markets around the globe across equities, fixed income, commodities, private investments. And we're what's great is that really builds an incredible mosaic, a cross current, so to speak, of kind of seeing how things are moving, seeing how things are valued. Are they tying into what the economic conditions in a particular geography are telling us? And then really from there, it's about identifying, hey, is there a risk that we think is becoming elevated that inside of our portfolios we want to shade away from? Or is there an opportunity that's presenting itself that we might want to lean into? But it's important, you know, I think you bring up a great point. Just because we look at the markets every single day and we are deep in them, we have a 30-plus person team that is doing this on a day-to-day basis, you know, I think realistically what we're bigger proponents of is realizing that timing markets is really never – it has not been a proven profitable experience to date. And so we are much bigger believers about time in the markets, not timing the markets. And I think sometimes we don't do anything, and that's a decision, right? There's a decision not to do anything. But I don't want it to come across that we are some tactical high turnover team. That's not really what we're about. We think it is about building resilient, diversified, long-term portfolios. But not being an ostrich and putting your head in the sand and saying, you know, wake up in 10 years, it'll be great. Realizing that risks and opportunities shift in medium and long-term patterns, and we try to edge the portfolio in the directions we think put it in the best place to kind of take advantage of that over the medium and long-term.
Thank you for that. I think it's really important, Doug, that listeners and even clients maybe sometimes have a better sense of what's going on behind the scenes. Listeners, if you did join us late, and you don't recognize the other voice with me, and you're not hearing Peg's voice, we're very fortunate today to have Doug Huber with us, Deputy Chief Investment Officer at Wealth Enhancement. Well, Doug, let's jump into it a little bit. We talked a little bit about your team and how you do what you do. So a lot going on. I'm just going to throw some stuff at you. Last week, you know, we were the president was talking about taking Greenland by force if he had to. NATO was all up in arms. The stock market didn't like it one bit. We saw a huge one-day drop. Then he reversed his position and said we would never take it by force. We've worked out the parameters of a potential deal that will make everybody happy, and the market bounced right back. But all these things going on, his – his war, the president's war with Chairman Powell and the Fed. I was reading some things this week about Jamie Dimon. He's suing Jamie Dimon. What do you make of all this, and what should investors and listeners make of all this day-to-day hubbub and of news that can potentially be damaging to the market? And let's include, again, what's going on right now, the political firestorm, the tragedy in Minneapolis, another shooting again yesterday. How do all these bad news things that frighten people, that concern people, what does that mean to them as investors, and what does that mean to you and your team when you're managing these portfolios?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great question, and you know, by no means do I want to minimize in the comments I'm about to make, you know, the events that are going on globally. But the fact of the matter is, you know, realistically, if you look back over long periods of time, barring an event on, you know, developed international or U.S. soil, most of these geopolitical events tend to occur in economies that are not terribly important to the global kind of supply chain and the global economies in general. And so what you see is a lot of these events are exactly what you just laid out. They're news headlines. And what do news headlines do? They create confusion. And I've been on the record of saying this, and certainly others are as well. Markets can price in bad news if it's known. What it struggles to price in is the unknown. And so when there are these periods of confusion, that's when you have these bouts of short-term volatility. The market instantly reacts to whatever the headline is, and it's whether it's algorithmic traders, whether it's individuals pressing a button. There's a knee-jerk reaction to some of this. They want to get out of the way of what is a perceived risk. I think realistically, there's most of the time these events have very, very little in the way of, if any, impact to the bigger economic data, to any of the true kind of market valuations of the underlying businesses. And so I hesitate to say it's noise, because that really minimizes what is going on. But as it relates to portfolios and an investor who is investing for their goals for the long term, these are mere blips on the radar in 9.9 out of 10 times, right? And so I think, you know, it's important to recognize that, yes, it feels uneasy, and you can see that reflected in how people react in the markets. It's how you kind of have to shut the brain off a little bit to this and say, you know, is this really having an impact to what I'm invested in? So going through kind of what you laid out, I mean, this administration is certainly for better or worse, an agent of change, right? And you have a president leading that administration that has literally written a book, The Art of the Deal, that the man is about getting things done the way he wants them. And so he often, you know, carries a huge, and swings around a huge hammer, kind of not afraid to break the china, and then kind of figure it out after the fact. And so it's constantly hard for us and any other market participants to figure out what is deal-making rhetoric versus what could actually come to fruition. Obviously, I think last year, the tariffs were real, right? Those have dramatic economic implications, or could have had. But, you know, things like Greenland, outside of upsetting our NATO partners, right, there's very little in the way of that having a dramatic effect on kind of our economy, on any underlying businesses. It's not like you have Google or Amazon, you know, 90% of their revenue comes from Greenland, right? That's not how it works, right? So I think, you know, these are, again, they're more part of the news cycle, that headline risk, as I'll call it. And the risk there is really volatility. It's about being able for a client and advisor to work together to realize, hey, I know it's scary, but selling at the bottom or selling during these periods, you know, it really is not beneficial. We've all seen those charts that if you miss the 10 best days in any given year, you know, you're wildly underperforming. And so it's important to stay invested and just kind of try to take these news headlines for what they are, realize that they certainly have big impacts to this social economic framework and other things. But as it relates to markets and the broader macro economy, they tend to be less impactful.
I want to pick up on something you just said, and I don't mean to throw you a curveball, Doug, but you just said everybody's seen those charts about if you miss the 10 best days. I think maybe you and I take for granted that everybody has seen those charts because we're in the industry and we've seen those charts. but I don't know that all listeners can relate to what you're talking about. Talk a little bit about that, how long-term investing, and you know, you mentioned it earlier in the show, it's not about timing the market, it's time in the market. Talk a little bit about the loss of return on investment for investors that try to jump in and out of the market and outthink it.
Yeah, sure, and you're absolutely right. I shouldn't have made that assumption. I don't think there's some mass mailing that goes around with that chart. Maybe there should be. But I think, you know, realistically, and it changes in any particular year, but let's just, I'll make a directionally accurate comment. My magnitude might be off a little bit, but usually if you miss the 5 to 10 best days in a given year, you know, that can equate to somewhere in the magnitude of 50 to 90% of an annual year's return. Now, that doesn't mean there's other things that don't contribute to it, but if you just took those in isolation, and so when do those tend to occur? Well, usually the best days tend to occur after drawdowns, right? After the market goes the other way, right? So you have, if you looked last year, right, we had those kind of tariff-induced, you know, market sell-off through February, really escalating into early April. Well, when we kind of got some clarity, there started to be deals made. There started to be the administration backing off some of these really crazy numbers like 100% tariffs. All of a sudden, the market said, okay, I can start to price this in. I'm getting comfortable with this. And you saw, you know, in early April, dramatic days. In fact, one of the days, I believe, was up close to 10 or 12% intraday. I don't know if it finished the day. I remember where I was because I looked at my phone and I was like, holy smokes. But just imagine if you had sold out, you know, in the day before and then you missed that 12% pop. Well, guess what? The market was up, what, 16 or 17 last year. That one day, had you missed it, would have cost you, you know, three quarters of your return. And so volatility in and of itself isn't a risk necessarily. It's a behavioral risk where you sell low and then buy back high, right? Real risk is permanent loss of capital. And that's really what our team is here to do, is to make sure we're in investments that don't get permanently impaired, that don't put a zero on somebody's statement, right? And so, you know, that's just an example of, you typically see the best days following tough periods. And so had you sold out towards the bottom because you started to get nervous, you miss those, and ultimately your returns don't look as good as the compounding of these indices over time.
So you already kind of anticipated my next question, but I'll maybe ask you to dig just or go a little bit deeper. And we've got about a little over 3 minutes left in the first half of the show, Doug. But talk a little bit more about 2025. And you already mentioned, and this is where I was going to go, if people think back to April, oh my gosh, the sky was falling. The market was retracting. People were terrified. The president was talking about all these tariffs. And 25 ended up being a really good year. But in April, nobody thought that was going to happen. So did 25 kind of go the way you and your team expected? Were you expecting a good year? Were there things that happened that you expected to happen? Were there things that surprised you? And then maybe in the second half of the show, we'll try to look ahead more to 2026 and hit some other topics and get listeners involved. But sum up 2025 for listeners, if you would, Doug.
Yeah, sure thing. I mean, you know, listen, we are as susceptible to those same behavioral instances as everybody is, right? And so I tell you, going into 25, we did think it was going to be a relatively constructive year. There was a pretty strong backdrop. And then, you know, in the first quarter, we had this tariff tantrum spike. And frankly, we hadn't seen tariffs to this degree in 100 years. And so there's very little anecdotal evidence to help us make decisions. And so what we actually had to do was go back to the drawing board, break down the economy into its real core pieces, and try to develop kind of scenarios from there of where could this go, because it wasn't something ourselves or any real market participants had ever seen. And so it was a little kind of unknown there. It was a little dark in the middle of you know, our vision was a little blurry towards the end of Q1. But, you know, ultimately, as we got more data, as we got more understanding of kind of how these tariffs would be, you know, implemented and what the true impact was, who was absorbing those tariffs. You know, I think it started to become clearer and clearer that the economic backdrop was still there. There was some positive tailwinds. And so it was a great year. I mean, listen, the third straight year of, I think, double-digit gains in the equity markets, a lot of that driven by what we'll call multiple expansion, and I'll come back to that in the second half because I think it's important when we talk about 2026. But it was a good year across almost every single underlying sector. AI certainly remained the primary theme, and I know we'll get into that. The big thing, I think, for 2025 to me was it was the first year in a very long time that globally diversified portfolios were a big benefit, right? You had international and emerging markets dramatically outpace the U.S., both up, you know, low 30%, in 2025 compared to the U.S., you know, up mid-high teens. And so, you know, it was nice to see international and EM stocks kind of outperforming in that globally diversified. The other thing I'd say is fixed income was behaving like fixed income. It was offering a ballast to the equity portfolio. We had had very high correlations. Those two were kind of moving in lockstep for a while. They diverged. And so, you know, fixed income was tending to do well when equities were down and vice versa. And so it was a good year for a diversified portfolio. I think a globally 60-40 portfolio was up, you know, somewhere in the mid-teens, which is an incredible year. And so I think that begs the question, and I'll leave a little bit of a cliffhanger here for the second half. You know, what does that mean for 2026? Can we keep the train moving at the pace it's been going? And so I know we'll get into that.
That's a perfect place to stop. Susie, I know we're ready for a break, and we'll Doug and I will finish our discussion and get listeners involved in the second half.
That sounds great. And if you are listening to this conversation and you have a question, this is your chance to jump in. 651-461-9226. 651-461-9226. And we are back with the second half of Your Money. Bruce Helmer, along with Doug Huber, on with us this next half hour, taking your texts and your calls at 651-461-9226. Bruce, you want to recap and go through a few things before we get to calls here and text? 651-461-9226. Bruce?
Yeah, thank you, Susie Jones. Thank you, listeners, for hanging in there again. If you joined us late and you just heard Susie say it, Doug Huber is with us today. Peg's got the week off. Doug, we appreciate your time. Doug is in the investment management department at Wealth Enhancement. He's a deputy chief investment officer. Doug and his team of 30-some-odd people are the people that are responsible for managing our portfolios on behalf of our clients. We talked a little bit in the first half of the show about Doug and his team and what they do and how they do it and logistically what the process is. Took you inside, if you will, a little bit and talked a little bit about how the sausage is made. And we talked about 2025 and what happened. It was a good year in the market, and we ended on a perfect note, Doug, kind of segueing into what we think will happen in 2026. And again, I'll do the disclaimer for you. Nobody knows what's going to happen in the short term. Anybody that tells you otherwise, anybody that tells you that they know, they're either misguided or they're dishonest. We don't know what will happen in the short term, but there's educated guesses or research or things that we can do to anticipate with some degree of confidence what we think will happen and why. And Doug, you made a bunch of great points about 2025 and how these things are going to lead into expectations for 2026. Doug?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, the big one, let's start at the top, you know, the broadest net here. I think it's questions around just is there continued reason to believe the economy both here and abroad will be as strong as it has been. You know, and a lot of market participants will look towards the Fed. And kind of what are they doing, right? And so the Fed for the better part of the last 18 months has been on a kind of programmatic rate cut path as it stands today. And the market likes that, right? That is positive to the markets when the lending rate goes down. And so, you know, there's a lot to do about what is the path for rate cuts in 2026. And I think while that is important, the underlying drivers of that are more important, right? And so the Fed is a dual mandate. They look at labor and inflation. And I think most of us also follow that path, right? And so labor has been relatively strong and continues to be so. So I think if you look at in January, we saw the December numbers. The latest jobless report showed a decrease down to 198,000. it's really rare to see a sub 200,000 number. I mean, that is a pretty kind of bullish number for the economy. That being said, you know, there's a lot of cross currents that could hit that, and we'll talk about that. But it's something we're paying a lot of attention to. As you hear announcements about layoffs, but they haven't been at such magnitude that they're making their way through to really moving the numbers quite yet. But we'll see kind of what could potentially move that as we go forward in this discussion. The other thing is just, you know, what's going on the inflation front. It has been stubbornly higher than the 2% target that the Fed has set forth as their mandate, but it is nowhere near the numbers we saw post-COVID. And so, you know, does it kind of continue to dwindle its way down where we're in this kind of disinflationary environment? And that's not to say deflation, where it's going the other way. It's just rising at a slower pace. And so with that, you know, that's really the two drivers that are informing the Fed. And I think the third and big one is just, what does monetary policy look like this year? And so as of right now, the market is pricing in roughly two cuts for this year, 225 basis points or 0.25% cuts for the remainder of this year. But we know that Fed Chair Powell comes out of the office in June. It is likely he's replaced with somebody that's a little bit more dovish or more likely to cut rates. And so we'll see kind of what the path for that is. But it's important to not cut rates too fast, because that could overheat the economy. So I think that's really what the Fed is trying to balance, of what is kind of a neutral rate in today's environment.
Doug, a couple follow-ups to what you just said. And by the way, listeners, I learn right along with you when I hear somebody like Doug talk about the economy and the things they look at and try to anticipate what markets will do and all the things they're looking at with inflation and the Fed and employment, unemployment, and so forth. But, Doug, one of the things I want to mention is you and I probably both, we do public speaking, we do, you know, things like this, education events, in my case, one-on-one with clients, and I'm always talking about the macro, and I really think it's important, and I'm trying harder to do this, to not be insensitive to individual people. You and I can sit and talk about the economy's great, the markets are great, but there's a lot of people out there right now going, I have to choose between getting medicine or getting groceries. You mentioned inflation. It's slowed down. It's not what it was, but it's still higher than we would like it to be, and people are still, you know, the new buzzword is affordability. People are out there having problems with affordability. So that's one issue, if you'd talk about the other one before I forget. The biggest single investment question I'm probably getting from people is that, when is the AI bubble going to burst? Everybody's talking about an AI bubble burst. So those two things, if you can talk about a little bit.
Yeah, sure thing. You know, you're absolutely right. And we, you know, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know how you want to look at it, you know, generally do spend our time thinking kind of way above, you know, the overlooking kind of all of the things that have come down to the individual level. And you're right. I think there's been a lot talked about this idea about what we're calling a K-shaped economy, where unfortunately you're seeing a wider and wider bifurcation between kind of those upper income earners and those that might be lower middle kind of income earners. And that is something that is, you know, it didn't just happen because of COVID. It didn't just happen this week. You know, this is something that is been structural to some monetary policy decisions going back to maybe the great financial crisis of 08 or even before that. And I think what has happened is, inadvertently, when you have accommodative monetary policy, which we did for a very long time following the GFC, that leads to an increase in asset prices. And so what are assets, right? They're homes. They're your stock and bond portfolios. Generally, this is a generalized statement, but generally, you know, who benefits from that? Likely those with a little bit more income or saved dollars, right? If you have extra, you tend to invest it. You might have a little bit more money, so you buy a house. Those have all appreciated and have been very beneficial for that particular kind of cohort of the population. Unfortunately, if you weren't as lucky to have a big pool of assets, your net worth has not grown at the same rate as others. And now we find ourselves in a position where you also are having an increase in the things you use day to day. And so your income hasn't grown quite as fast and is not supportive of being able to afford those things. And so you're absolutely right. There is this bifurcation. again, unfortunately, fortunately, depend on how you want to look at it. You know, the upper end of the consumer spectrum really is what drives the economy. They tend to account for a much higher percentile of the spend that goes into our GDP and other things than the lower income cohort. And so what looks rosy at the high level because of that, you're absolutely right, does not necessarily filter down to everyone. And so that is an important point, number one. Number two, there's associated risks with that over longer periods of time. And that's actually something we spend a lot of time looking at, of just, you know, what are the particular, we actually, you know, bifurcate the consumer into different groups. And we actually look at that at a very granular level of kind of what each quartile is looking like in terms of their health, their spend, and other things like that to kind of get a better picture of what's going on underneath the surface.
Hey, Doug. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I was going to say, I'll come back to the AI question, but Susie tells me we do have a caller on the line, and we always like try to take those so they don't have to hold too long. Susie, let's go ahead and take the call.
All right. Mark is calling this morning from New Prague, Minnesota. Mark, go ahead. You're on the air with Bruce and our special guest, Doug Huber.
Yeah, Doug, I have a question for you. It's in regards to the United States national debt. Currently, it's $38.5 trillion, and we have several countries that bought up U.S. treasuries, and the total is $5.5 trillion that these foreign countries, Japan, the United Kingdom, China, the Cayman Islands, Belgium, Canada, Luxembourg, France, Ireland, Switzerland, if all these countries call in them bonds and cash out on them, what does that mean for the stock market? Wouldn't that crash immediately if all these countries cashed out on and claimed their money with the U.S. treasuries?
Hey, Mark, thanks for listening. Mark, thanks for listening. That's a really good question. And, Doug, you know, I mentioned AI is the question I'm getting most recently. But historically, Mark has absolutely hit the question I've gotten most often over the years, and that is, what about the federal deficit spending and the federal debt?
Yeah, so there's probably two underlying things to touch on there, and I'll try to get through them quickly here. I think the absolute level of the U.S. national debt is surprising and growing, you know, every day, and likely, you know, the concern level is stepping up with that on a daily basis. And I think you actually see that on the what we call the back end or the longer end of the Treasury curve. You've noticed that the front end has come down as the Federal Reserve has cut rates, but the back end has stayed stubbornly high. Think of the 30-year Treasury bond. And that's because it's something called a term premium, right? That is really where that end of the curve is where the market is pricing in kind of the risk of the functioning of kind of our markets, right? The risk of the U.S. Treasury being the default safe haven security. And so it is demanding still a little bit more out there because of things like deficits, like fiscal policy. And so the market is seeing that. So you're spot on in your question in that regard. The question around what happens if that $5.5 trillion gets sold. First and foremost, you know, it would be a really draconian scenario to assume that every international holder of our bonds would press the sell button simultaneously. I think you've seen little blips in the radar. You know, I think Denmark came out and said they're selling their 120 million or whatever it was. I mean, the U.S. Treasury market is one of the most liquid markets in the world. And so, you know, it can absorb flows in pretty high numbers. I think the other thing to think about is, while foreign institutions might believe that there is a reason to get rid of their U.S. treasuries, that isn't to say there isn't domestic and other pockets of demand that wouldn't be there to absorb that, right? We know that insurance companies, pensions, these things that are what we call liability-driven investors, have to build their coffers to duration match their liability. And so they're always in the market to absorb. The bigger risk, I think, and to get at the crux of the question is, do we lose the honor of being the true global risk-free security? If that were to happen, then yes, we have a much bigger problem, right? We have a significant issue that would affect bond markets, it would affect equity markets, it would affect everything, right? And so it is important that we continue to maintain our posture as the true risk-free place to be, and that what everything else is priced off. You know, the other thing you'd have to ask too, as a follow on, is the U.S. dollar continue to be kind of the currency? And I think those two would go hand in hand, but it would take a seismic shift, and I can't even fathom to think what that would be to really drive $5.5 trillion of foreign holdings to be sold at one point in time. But you're absolutely right. I mean, if that ever occurred, there would be significant ripples from that.
Hey, Doug, and Mark, thank you for that thoughtful question. And Doug, thank you for that great answer. Doug, one of the things when I get variations of that question from clients and prospects, I think, you know, again, it's easy to be focused on the debt, and I understand that. It's relevant. It's important. But I always tell people not to oversimplify this, and you tell me if I am being oversimplistic. I don't have the technical expertise that you do. I'm just a dumb kid from Olivia, Minnesota. But I always tell people the debt is only one part of the equation. If you put this on a personal level, if I have a balance sheet with $1 million in assets and $100,000 of debt, my debt-to-asset ratio is 10%. If my debt doubles and someone goes, oh, my gosh, your debt doubled, you have $200,000 worth of debt, but I now have $10 million of assets, even though my debt is doubled, that's a much stronger balance sheet because I have 10 times as many assets. So I tell clients all the time, what we look at is debt to GDP, and as long as we have a robust economy with a strong growing GDP, I'm less concerned about that debt. Is that too simplistic? Is that a bad answer? Have I been misguiding my clients when I say that?
No, you have not. Debt to GDP is certainly the metric that I think, you know, most would point to. And, you know, admittedly, debt to GDP is also still high, right? We're scratching the high 120s, if not low 130% of debt to GDP. Now, is that a systemic issue quite yet? No. Unfortunately, there's no research or history to know exactly what the bad number is. There has been some work done by the IMF and some others that would suggest it's closer to 180% where concerns really start to ramp up. But to your point, Bruce, you're right. We do have a good economy. GDP continues to grow. And if we can get our kind of house of cards in order and stop running huge deficits, then yeah, hopefully our debt to GDP will come down. And it actually has been on a downward trajectory the past couple of years, albeit at a pretty slow pace. Now the risk is, you know, do you go the other way? But I think for right now, it is not at a point that we would deem it, you know, so significant that it's a huge risk. But I do think, to my point earlier, the market is certainly starting to indicate, hey, we're paying attention, you know, be careful here. And so I think it'll be important to see what the next several years hold for how do we handle kind of all of the checks we've written. You know, can we make sure they can be cashed?
Hey, Doug, we've got a little less than 5 minutes left, and I want to make sure the listeners can get in at least one more time. But before we do that, I know I asked you a question about AI, and if you want to address that, you can. But maybe is there one key takeaway, one definite message that you wanted to convey to listeners today that maybe we haven't yet? And I'll give you a chance to do that before we get in another question or two.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think we need to touch on AI at least for a minute, just because I think that is one of the biggest cross currents we're seeing in the markets today. I think as we look at 2026, we do feel that at least for now, you know, data is very quick and does change. We do think the economic backdrop remains constructive. We do think that, you know, 2026, we do see, and this is early days, but we do think it's a market that probably benefits from more dispersion of returns. It's not going to continue to be led by just a handful of names, we think. We think AI is getting to a point where its broader impacts are going to be felt across more sectors, across more companies themselves, and so on the equity side. I think we think there will be some more dispersion. We could totally be wrong in that, but I think dispersion is a good thing. I do think that we are continuing to watch kind of how fixed income behaves relative to equities, but we hope to see a continued decline in what we call correlation, or kind of do they move in opposite directions of each other? That's a positive thing for portfolios. You know, fixed income, one of its purposes is to serve as kind of a ballast to your equity portfolio. And so correlations have been declining. We hope they continue to decline to a more normalized level. But you see these periods where you get this Sell America trade we had a few days ago where both equities and bonds sold off together. Those are not ideal for client portfolios. So something to watch there. But we do think, you know, on the whole, things are pretty positive. Happy to go into AI, or we can go to a question.
Susie, can we get at least one or two in from listeners?
All right, 651-461-9226, a question here. When should someone consider using tax-exempt bonds in a portfolio?
Oh, what a good question. Doug, you want to take that one?
Sure. You know, I have varying degrees of views on this. So Bruce, I'll actually let you chime in as well. But, you know, I think it is certainly on an individual circumstance. You know, nobody loves paying taxes. And so if you can generate some income that is, you know, not subject to your ordinary income tax bracket, that's fantastic. I do think, you know, in general, municipal markets remain relatively healthy. There's always something we look at, the muni treasury ratio, how attractive are tax exempt bonds relative to taxable bonds. And, you know, that it's pretty normalized today. I'm not saying it's a huge don't buy or a huge buy. It's kind of in that path. I'd say the important thing to think about is that muni bonds are one tool in the toolkit. And so, you know, I always encourage, even at the highest tax brackets, it's important to also have some taxable fixed income that brings other types of exposures to a portfolio. It's good diversification to still have corporate credit in there, to have some of the securitized credit in there, to have U.S. treasuries. But obviously, as wealth spectrums continue to increase, the use case and the benefits of tax-exempt muni bonds are higher and higher. And the other thing I'd add is obviously state-specific certainly matters. So we know there's a handful of very high-tax states, whether that's California, New York, Minnesota, Massachusetts, New Jersey. You know, there's a few that, you know, state-specific where you get the double tax exemption is also important. But, Bruce, I don't know if you have anything that you particularly use as a guidepost as it relates to levels of net worth or other things.
No, you answered it perfectly. Again, it comes down to diversification, both from asset allocation or asset class, but also tax diversification. We talk about these things all the time on this show to clients, and that's exactly what you talked about. I'll say that munis are certainly going to be more attractive to somebody in a high tax bracket, and we use them outside of tax-deferred accounts. We use them in the taxable part of the portfolio. I know, Doug, I wish that it went so fast. I appreciate your expertise and your time. I thank you for being on today, but I know Susie's about to play the music and give us the hook. We're out of time.
All right. Thanks to both of you. If you did not get your question answered, you can email yourmoney@wealthenhancement.com or call 1-888-6-ADVICE and do it that way. Have a great day.